The following episode was recorded August 31st, 2021. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to James Cameron's Titanic Scene by Scene. I'm Brittany Butler.
I'm Ethan Brim.
And we're back again.
It's only been a week.
Yeah. Getting right into it. But yeah, we do have a voice message sent in via Anchor. If any of you want to do that, there should be a link in the description to do so. Yeah, I'm just excited to play a voice message.
Yeah, me too.
We don't have a fancy voicemail segment soundbite like we do on our other podcast. I'm not really quite sure how we would edit one of those, so I might just put the little voicemail sound.
You've got mail.
So yeah, for the first time on this podcast, it's time to check our voice messages.
You have one unheard message. First unheard message.
Hi, Brittany and Ethan. This is Katie from Hampshire in the UK, not too far from Southampton. I've discovered your podcast a few weeks ago, and since then I've rediscovered Titanic and become slightly obsessed with it again. I remember watching it the first time around and loving it when I saw it in the cinema. And I've been rewatching the deluxe collector's edition DVD and watching all the behind the scenes clips and absolutely loving it. And my question for you is how you feel about behind the scenes and analysing a film in detail, and whether that changes how you experience the film rather than just letting the film wash over you. I love all the behind the scenes stuff and appreciating all the work that goes into a film. But my husband, on the other hand, doesn't want to know and thinks it spoils the film. So I think I know which way you're going to come down on that, but I'd just love to know your thoughts.
Yeah.
Good topic.
Thank you, Katie, so much for sending that in. It was great to hear from you.
Yeah.
And yeah, really good question, because I feel like this kind of ties into why I feel like it subconsciously has to do with why we've taken breaks. Over this last break, I just started realizing that I really don't want to get Titanic'd out, like, especially with, you know, what we're doing.
You mean you're not already Titanic'd out?
Like, yeah, I know.
Your whole life is...
I thought about it. I'm like, I should be way past that. But it made me think of what Liz said, how she tried to make sure that she didn't watch the movie for like years, or at least as long as she could, because she didn't want the movie to lose the magic or whatever.
Yeah.
And I'm way past that. But then I just started thinking about that, and how now that I've been analyzing it so in depth, I was wondering, like, you know, I was like, for one of the next times I watch it straight through, am I just going to be thinking about all of this stuff, or will I be enjoying the movie? I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many ways to approach this. The first thing I thought of when she was saying that was I live here in California, Southern California, and my best friend went to Disneyland when we were right out after high school. I remember it was the Peter Pan ride, and I remember learning about, you know, how they make certain things work on that ride. And there's like this one part where there are stars that it looks like they're like 3D coming at you stars. It's like a nighttime. You take a ship over Neverland and there are stars. And I remember saying to my friend, I said, oh, do you know how they do those stars? It's really cool. And he's like, no, I don't want to know. I don't want to know. Mm-hmm. I don't want to ruin the magic. I mean, but I understood where he's coming from. But with that said, I think understanding what makes it magical almost enhances it. But I think it also depends on who you are. Like, a magician wants to know the secret to another magician's trick, because to him, that's part of what makes it so awesome. Whereas there are a lot of people who watch magic who don't want to know how it works. But I do think if you watch a movie on an analytical level, you have to think about it in terms of how it's made, because that's just what makes it the medium that it is. Mm. Otherwise, it will become almost boring. So I think if you're watching something multiple times, I think understanding what goes into it levels that experience up for you.
No, yeah, definitely. I don't know. I just couldn't help but think, I feel like I'm going to be in the same boat as Liz was.
Yeah.
When we're done with this podcast, I'm going to have to take like 5 years off from Titanic. Like, I feel like I'm going to have to like not watch the movie for at least 5 years or something. Get all of this analytical stuff out of my system, step away from it for a really long time, and then come back and revisit it. unless it's released in theaters again for the 25th anniversary.
Which it will be.
Then I'll have to see it in theaters.
I'm kind of a person who famously doesn't like watching movies a lot, like the same movie multiple times. Mm-hmm. And I know people are like, oh, I watch this movie every year on Halloween or this other movie every year on Christmas. And I tried doing that with a couple movies, and if they're not masterful and like layered, those movies will get tiresome for me, at least. Mm. So I think there's multiple answers. There's no right answer to the question, I don't think. I think it just depends on who you are and what the movie is. And that's why television's so good, because it has a million episodes, so.
Plenty of things to talk about.
Yeah.
But like we've said before, this movie is almost endless for things to talk about.
Yeah, no, it is. Yeah.
To a degree, definitely.
Oh, yeah. We were both saying it, I think. I mean, this is one of the unique ones. There's certain movies that just have that layered aspect to it, and Titanic's definitely one of them.
Yeah.
It's a good thing to talk about, though.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, so once again, thank you, Katie, for sending in that voice message. If any of you listening would like to do the same, as I said, there should be a link to do so via Anchor in the description of this podcast episode. So another thing I kind of just wanted to mention before we get into the scene, Life magazine put out a like Titanic special edition thing. I was just in line at the supermarket and I look to my left and then bam, there's just Titanic sitting there. And I'm just like, this is so inescapable. And granted, this is about the sinking and it has like a really nice painting of the sinking and the tragedy on the cover. But the title of the magazine, it says, Titanic, the tragedy that shook the world, plus the movie remembered. And I said, and of course I had to buy it, so I have it right here. When it says the movie remembered, everyone knows what movie you're talking about. Like, you know what I mean?
Wait, what movie is it? Is it the movie called Remembered?
The movie Remembered. They forgot to put the quotes around Remembered to let us know that that's the movie they're talking about. I don't know, just something as small as that just made me think of how synonymous this movie has become with the Titanic and the history. All they have to do is say, plus the movie Remembered, that's it. Like, that is the Titanic movie.
Yeah, it'll be 100 years from now and literally still no one's ever going to come out with another Titanic-related movie, probably. Unless they think of something super creative, like kind of tangentially to the ship, but I don't know.
I think about that all the time, and I've seen a lot of rumors that are like, oh, you know, they're planning a Titanic sequel or like a Titanic something of some sort. And one thing that they could do that I've seen someone make a concept trailer for is Rose's life post-Titanic.
Post-Titanic, yeah. Yeah, oh yeah, totally. Or even like a prequel. I've heard that with Jack there, like someone was like, oh, I should do a prequel, and it was like in the news for a while, but that might make it lose a little bit of the magic of who he is, though.
Yeah.
He has a mystique.
You know, but for a sequel or like a follow-up sort of one that they could do, as I said, you know, Rose's life could actually be pretty cool. Like, they could get Kate Winslet back, because there is a concept trailer of that out there that like someone just, you know, edited a bunch of different Kate Winslet movies together to try to tell a story, and you know, but it was actually really kind of cool as I thought about it, and I was like, whoa, like it kind of reminds me, I'm going to mention Star Wars again, Luke, right? The way we see him in Return of the Jedi, and then there's all these years that go by before we see him again in the sequels.
Yeah.
And people were like, you know, why don't they do a series?
Yeah, so I think we're going to see that now. Hopefully, I mean, I think it'd be cool, but
it made me think of that, because I was like, well, think about it. Rose made it off of the Titanic when she was 17, going on 18, and then we don't meet her again until she's 101, or like 100.
Yeah.
So, like, who knows what sort of stuff they could tell in there, and she clearly was well-traveled, and you know, she lived a lot of life. Mm-hmm. And I think it could also be an interesting angle of, we're not at the end of the movie yet, but she eventually tells everyone that she's telling the story to that she's never spoken of Jack until then to them. So I feel like that could just be kind of interesting, of how she got married and had kids but never told anyone about Jack. And that was just something that she kept to herself and sort of lived for in a way. Like, you know what I mean? Like, she kept that to herself, but so much of what she did was in honor of him. Yeah. So I don't know. I feel like it could be a really emotionally resonant, nice sort of thing.
Yeah. They'd have to find a way to like propel it, I guess. Because you need a conflict, right? So like, what would it be? I mean, I think within the right hands, James Cameron has to have ideas.
And plus there's also the necklace angle, right? So she kept that.
Yeah.
That constant struggle maybe of wanting to turn it in to live an easier life, but not wanting to be tracked down and found by Cal.
Yeah, a crime drama where these like burglars come and try to do a heist on the necklace. And she learns kung fu to stop them.
Oh, man, yeah. Honestly, I feel like there is potential there, though.
Yeah, but even outside of the Cameron-verse,
there have been other Titanic movies made since. You know, I agree that there are different stories they could tell, and they could take a more historical approach, and they could make the movie what some people wanted this movie to be.
Yeah.
You know, or at least more in line with what a lot of people wanted this movie to be. But I still think if it was done by any other filmmaker, I mean, what are you going to get, right? Like, as we've said before, what filmmaker really cared, like, so much about Titanic to go to the lengths that James Cameron went to? I don't know. I feel like he just captured so much of the spirit, just, like, really beautifully.
Then the music, I mean, you can't, you're not going to get better
than that. Yeah, the music, you can't. There's so many components to what makes this movie so great that it's just almost impossible to imagine another movie coming even close to what this was able to achieve.
Yeah, totally.
Anyway, so that was quite a long intro before we get to this scene.
It's good, though. It was meaty.
Yeah, it's good. Good stuff. Always interesting stuff to discuss. So, getting into the scene. So this is titled Women and Children First. The scene starts off with a very catatonic Captain Smith in disbelief of what's happening now. You know, we left off with Bride telling him that the Carpathia will be there in 4 hours. And we know that Titanic only has an hour or two at the most of life left. So he is here knowing that this situation is extremely dire. And so he's portrayed in this scene as being almost like checked out, barely going through the motions and just being prompted. And there are, as we get it, you know, further into the sinking stuff now, there were conflicting reports, according to at least James Cameron on the commentary, that there are some claims that he was a little slow to react and needed some prompting from Lightoller. But there are other people who say he was working well and helping and doing the best he could. So, I mean, I feel like it was probably somewhere in the middle, maybe, but
yeah.
Cameron, like, with a few things now, as we get into the back end of the movie, he took his own personal artistic liberties with certain things, and he sort of liked the more catatonic, dazed out direction, and so he sort of leaned into that.
I think it might be even more of a relatable reaction,
especially
because this is something that, I mean, almost nobody can relate to.
Yeah.
Like on a surface level. So, I mean, maybe it might come after a little adrenaline rush and like trying to figure stuff out. But like a lot of times when things are flooding into your system, you're just kind of, your body responds by just being lethargic.
There was a deleted scene that kind of shows him taking a little bit more initiative. And this is a historical piece of information, I believe, where he takes one of those things. I don't know what it's called.
Not a megaphone, but a, I guess, well, there's another word for it, like a megaphone, I guess.
It's just like a big
cone.
Yeah, cone, basically. We sound so stupid.
The like cone, the dunce cap that they cut a hole into.
But yeah, they had like a giant one of those.
Yeah.
And he like stood on the side of the ship speaking to lifeboats that had been rowing out saying like, come back to the ship. This is the captain speaking. Come back to the ship.
Mm-hmm.
And of course they don't listen. And he just sort of says, they're fools. But yeah, it was sort of like a low energy kind of scene, so I can see why it was cut, I guess. So Lightoller asks Captain Smith if they should move forward with women and children first as the order, and Captain Smith just agrees, yes, women and children first. So Lightoller does his job, he gets everyone lined up, tells them at the time being they'll be taking only women and children, but this is where there was, I guess, a little bit of miscommunication to a degree. Mm-hmm. Instead of me just saying the situation, I'm going to just read it from this National Geographic that I have. It says, yeah, so of course there was the aspect of the crew doubting that the lowering mechanisms could bear the weight of the full 70 passengers that each lifeboat was said to have been able to hold. And they knew that they couldn't waste any time, so that's why a lot of the lifeboats weren't launched very full. As well as when Smith ordered lifeboats filled, he said women and children first, and Lightoller filled the boats with women and children only.
Oh, got it.
So that was the difference. And then it says Officer Murdoch on the starboard side interpreted the order differently. He boarded as many women and children as were available and then gave the remaining seats to men, which is what the order was, I believe. But
yeah, yeah.
But, you know, Lightoller was just like only women and children. So that's why a lot of the men perished and why a lot of the boats weren't launched very full.
Got it.
So then we cut to the band setting up on the deck, and we have Wallace Hartley, the band leader, saying, mm-hmm. all right, nice and cheery, like the captain said. So there's no panic, right? That circles back to something we talked about earlier in the movie, and it's also just a blurb in the screenplay about this, so I'm just going to read it because I just think it's kind of funny. It says, as discussed earlier, preview audiences had an unexpected adverse reaction to scenes involving the band, in addition to planting their story within the context of Brock Lovett's interview, where he had said, oh, like everyone knows the story of Titanic with the band playing till the end and all of that, to just throw that into his news story so that everyone knew that that was a historical aspect.
Huh.
There was also this part that they threw in. So it says, Cameron added dialogue in post for band leader Wallace Hartley saying, quote, all right, boys, like the captain said, nice and cheery so there's no panic. The addition of this dialogue, making it the captain's orders, explained the motivation for playing on deck. Titanic historian Don Lynch said, quote, in this day and age, when we can push a button and hear practically any kind of music we want, it can be hard to appreciate what sort of impact live music could have had on a crowd in 1912. That's one of the reasons Hartley's band is remembered with so much fondness.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, when I'm stressed out, I listen to Enya.
You know, James Cameron wanted Enya to score this movie.
Really?
Yes.
Oh, that'd have been cool. I mean, like, I love Enya, so. But this is, I mean, it's good as it is, but that'd have been cool, though, still. I'm interested.
I feel like remembering hearing that he asked James Horner to try to compose the music in the style of Enya.
Yeah, you could see, you could hear that, for sure.
I mean, like, with the vocals and,
yeah. Totally. That's cool.
Mm-hmm. I also love how Enya is mentioned in School of Rock, which is my other favorite movie.
Yeah. Oh, is that Beethoven, Mozart, Enya?
Yeah.
Classically, take him to the classical concert.
Yeah, he's like the classics.
Play all the classics.
Anyway, so it cuts to a scene in the third class where we see Fabrizio and Tommy sort of, you know, running through this hallway trying to get to the decks. And I think it is intentional that Tommy is the one that gets a life vest and Fabrizio doesn't. Later on, the situation of...
Got it.
Yeah. But in the moment, they're just rushing and, you know, who cares about a life belt right now? Like, I just gotta get to the decks. So this leads us to another sort of controversial aspect of this movie. We see a lot of the third class passengers pretty much locked below decks now with a literal gate and a steward trying to tell them, you know, it isn't time to go up to the boats yet. Stay calm. And so this was always, like I said, of a bit of a controversial thing. And a lot of people would often ask, were there really gates on the Titanic that kept the third class people down. And so I found an article on the BBC about this. It was one of the more straightforward things I could find on it.
Yeah.
So I will read it here. So it says, one of the most emotive scenes in Cameron's Titanic portrays the third class passengers as being forcibly held below decks, prevented from reaching the lifeboats. Richard Howells, who is a cultural sociologist, according to Google, argues that there is no historical evidence to support this. Gates did exist, which barred third class passengers from the other passengers, but this was not in anticipation of a shipwreck, but in compliance with the U.S. immigration laws and the feared spread of infectious diseases. The British Inquiry report noted that the Titanic was in compliance with the American immigration law in force at the time, and that allegations that third class passengers were locked below decks were false. Evidence given at the inquiry did suggest that initially some of the gates blocked the way of the steerage passengers as stewards waited for instructions, and that they were then opened, but only after most of the lifeboats had been launched. It was also noted that third-class passengers were, quote, reluctant to leave the ship, quote, unwilling to part with their baggage, and had difficulty getting from their quarters to the lifeboats. None of the evidence presented pointed to any malicious intent to obstruct third-class passengers, but rather an oversight caused by the unthinking obedience to the regulations. But the results were still deadly. I feel like in the movie, it can sort of be presented as they're third class, so they're scum and they're locked below the gates and they're not worthy of going to the lifeboats on time, so stay back. It does sort of have that connotation you could look at it with, but...
But also, I feel like if there is that mentality, which I'm sure there was for some people, for a lot of people even, but they wouldn't let them on the ship in the first place, you know? The fact that they were allowed on to the Titanic as third class citizens, I don't know.
Yeah, because, I mean, and there's definitely, you know, there's a scene in a Walk to Remember.
in the movie Remember?
Yeah, A Walk to Remember. I love that movie, though. Good teen movie there. No, in A Night to Remember, there is like a really brief scene. We see passengers knocking down a gate. So, I mean, it has been included at least in one other instance in another Titanic movie. Not as dramatically as it is here, but...
Is that the 50s, that movie?
1958, yeah.
58.
That sort of concept of, you know, it's like, oh, it's because they're poor, they don't get... special treatment is also sort of reinforced when we see the Irish mum again and she's talking to her kids.
And gentlemen, allow the women and children through to the front.
What are we doing, Mommy?
We're just waiting, dear. When they finish putting first-class people in the boats, they'll be starting with us and we'll want to be all ready, won't we?
Everybody not just quiet.
It sort of like vilifies the first class and some of the crew kind of in that way.
Yeah. Or even just the general way of thinking back then was that there was preferential treatment towards people who had money and people who were like of higher social standard.
And then what's interesting, though, is that there's also the aspect that I believe this was on the historical commentary that they mentioned this, that the third class, it also wasn't necessarily all poor people. It could have just been people who didn't want to pay as much money for a ticket.
Yeah, that's true too. Yeah, because it's just the ticket price, right? It's not necessarily. Yeah, that's true. And if someone's just like, yeah, I just don't really feel like paying that. Yeah.
That's, it's like, that's I just need to get from point A to point B. Like, you know, I don't need first class treatment. But cutting to that Irish mom and her kids is another really small, subtle development for that little family.
Yeah, and that's one of the harsher moments in there. Because we see how it affects Rose and her family and stuff. But you also that's what drives the empathy is more of seeing the third class people, especially the children. It's hard to watch, I think.
So then it cuts to the first lifeboat being lowered, which was Lifeboat 7. That was the first one to launch. And we have Murdoch ordering it lower away, left and right together, steady. And again, we mentioned that they're doing this by hand, which is a lot.
Yeah, just the process of them lowering the boat I thought was fascinating.
Yeah.
I was enthralled by it. I was like, holy mackerel, just them having to do this over and over and over again, you just feel that tedium.
Yeah, and you feel the pressure of needing to do all of this manual work in crunch time.
Yeah, there's like suspense even in just that little fine moment right there.
It's been said that the people who got into that lifeboat or got into the lifeboats early were really brave to do so.
Yeah.
To just step away from the comfort of the Titanic, which at that point was seemingly still rock solid to a lot of people.
That's a good point.
Yeah. To just get in those boats and just row away without a lot of their belongings and...
abandon ship. Yeah, literally abandoning ship.
To just to take that chance.
Yeah, that's true. That's a good point. Because like, yeah, you don't think about that. You're like, oh, okay, good, they're safe now. But back then, when you're in the moment, that's got to be terrifying.
Yeah, because it was also a 60-foot drop to the ocean from the deck of the Titanic. Oh, so
that's right, yeah.
The ride down on that boat is terrifying. The people start to panic when one side is lowered a little too far than the other.
Yeah.
And again, it's all being done by hand, so it is quite scary. When you see the davits shaking, they make a point to film. You know, the davit is that crane that sort of holds the holds the ropes. As they're lowering them, they're just shaking like crazy, right? And so there are so many different elements that make this a very scary thing to do and to get onto. And what was interesting is on the historical commentary, they said that the davits on the set ship was built by the same brand on Titanic, and they were actually built stronger than the ones on Titanic, and the set lifeboats were lighter than the lifeboats on Titanic. So that means those davits were built stronger and the set lifeboats were lighter and they were still shaking that much.
Yeah.
If the davits on Titanic were weaker and the boats were heavier, I can't imagine how much that might have been shaking and how scary that would have been.
Or even like, I'm surprised none of them actually like just snapped off.
Yeah, God. And as brave as it was to get on those lifeboats, you know, there were people who thought that they were just going to row out for a little bit while they repair whatever damage needs to be repaired. And then they'll just row on back in and just get on their way. So then we see a distress flare rocket set off, and it looks like a firework in the sky. And they cut to this little girl who looks up at it, and her face is illuminated by the light of the rocket, and she almost has like little stars in her eyes looking at it like, oh, like look at the firework, it's so pretty, sort of thing, right? And then immediately after cutting to her, it cuts to Rose, who's looking at it, and she knows what the real meaning behind it is. And there was always something about that that stood out to me, just the inclusion of that little girl. Like I wrote in my notes, what did I say? I said I kind of like the back-to-back cut, you know, how they view it so differently, sort of like an innocence with the child of like ignorance is bliss or something.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Like obviously Rose is like disillusioned at this point and she's going to become even more disillusioned. And even regardless of Cal and all that stuff, even if she wasn't disillusioned, just like the natural, you can't help but just start to become less quote unquote ignorant as you get older and just kind of understand those things. It's an interesting moment, even if just like an intangible subtext, I guess. But
yeah, and I was hoping that there would maybe be something about it in the screenplay, but I didn't see anything. I was hoping there would be a little underlying thing of like, it cuts to a girl, blah, 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 with like a little like description of why that shot was wanted. But couldn't find anything. Yeah, and I just wrote that the flare shot looks really great when they cut to the shot of Titanic. The bow is almost under already.
Yeah.
It's pretty early and it's moving pretty fast. So then we head back into the little holding room where Jack is being monitored by Lovejoy, who is loading his gun and saying,
you know, I do believe this ship may sink.
You don't say, buddy. Thanks for the reminder. This is just...
He's more annoying than Cal to me, just because...
Yeah,
like,
you've
Cal's...
said that. You've said that before.
Yeah, I know. Oh, I didn't know. I mean, it's been so long, but...
I know. It's sometimes hard to remember what we have or haven't said. But, yeah. And so that's when he says...
I've been asked to give you this small token of our appreciation. Compliments of Mr. Caledon Hotley.
I had mentioned that before because that comes up in a deleted scene where Jack gets his revenge on Lovejoy and punches him and says compliments of the Chippewa Falls Dawsons and punches Lovejoy.
That's funny.
It's really extra, but yeah, I mentioned before that just would have been like a really cheesy payoff, setup and payoff.
You should make like a mega cut with just all the deleted scenes and just...
I should do a mega cut of every setup and payoff.
Yeah, oh, that'd be good too, yeah.
Just all back to back.
Yeah. And then there's this great shot behind with Jack behind the window.
Oh, yeah, looking out the porthole.
I love that shot. I was like, holy cow, that's a cool shot. I rewound it and watched it a few times because it just looked cool. It's like saying things without saying things, right? Like you see the water and then, yeah, it's just a cool shot.
They use it. They come back to it after this as like a measurement of the sinking. Yep. So like we keep coming back to Jack and he's lower and lower. He can't see up. He can't see the surface anymore. And it's just sort of a cool thing to return to. But yeah, I had that in my notes how I said I love how they return to this and how it shows the progression of the sinking, basically. Mm-hmm. It's kind of a cool way to do it.
Really cool.
And also a very scary way to do it, right? Because he's trapped down there and that's his only connection to the outside and what's going on, and it just keeps disappearing. Like he's just getting lower and lower, you know, knowing that no one else is going to be around him down there now at this point. Like, everyone's going to be heading up to the deck, so.
For all he knows, because he thinks Rose is like, screw you at this point. I don't know. At least we think that he thinks that.
So Jack is left doubled over in pain down there as Lovejoy walks away and takes the handcuff key with him. So isn't that nice?
Yep. What a sweetie.
Yeah. Then we get Ruth, Rose, and Cal, as well as Molly Brown and some other first-class passengers, about to get on a lifeboat. Rose is looking at some couples hugging goodbye, and Ruth shouts out loud, asking,
"Will the lifeboats be seated according to class? I hope they're not too crowded."
And then driving the point home there.
I know that, I hope they're not too crowded. And she's like giggling about it as if, you know, oh, whatever. Oh, like, man. What a trivial little thing we have to go through today, you know.
When I'm nervous, I say pretentious things.
Poor people behavior that we're having to engage in right now. But and so Rose is starting to get pretty fed up right about now. Pretty awesome. She just grabs her mother and she tells her,
"Oh, mother, shut up. Don't you understand? The water is freezing and there aren't enough boats. Not enough by half. Half the people on this ship are going to die.
Not the better half."
And Cal interjects by saying, "Not the better half." You know, Rose just kind of looks over at him, you know, just gives him this disgusted look. And she's just putting these pieces together more and more in her head, you know, that she already knew the kind of person he is. So she has her mom getting onto the lifeboat. She has Molly Brown telling her, like, "Oh, come on, Rose." I mean, she's faced with a lot of decisions throughout the movie, but this is like a big one.
Yeah, it's literally like, the metaphor, like, get onto the lifeboat or stay on the sinking ship.
Mm-hmm.
Literally that metaphor. So
she's deciding, you know, do I want to live and stay with these people that I am unhappy with and be, you know, in a life that will still be carved out for her?
Yeah.
Or am I going to take this as almost an opportunity of some kind to stay on the ship and risk spending either the last hour or so of my life with someone who I've really grown to care about and connect with, and potentially surviving and living a new life with him.
Yeah.
So it's really like, this is sort of that big decision moment. They quite literally have her have a light bulb moment by having a flare go off.
I didn't even think about that.
But it's really nice, though.
Yeah.
So she's doing this whole thought process here, you can tell, of like looking at the lifeboat, looking back to Cal. And then he says, you know, it's a pity I didn't keep that drawing. It'll be worth a lot more by morning, about Jack's drawing of her and how, you know, he's going to be dead. This would have been worth a lot more money.
Selling a picture of his naked fiance or whatever.
I know it's weird, but still, you know, just what a thing to say, right?
Yeah.
That's when the flare goes off, sort of just like illuminates Rose's face. It's a beautiful shot, though.
Mm-hmm.
She sits there for a minute, she takes it in, and she just says,
"You unimaginable bastard."
Which is such a great line. It's a great moment.
Yeah.
Because really, just in that moment, it's like, wow.
Well, real quick, to what Ruth says, you know, about the seated according to class and stuff. In one sense, it feels like it is gratuitous in driving home the point of these people are hoity-toity, but it's utilized to spark something in Rose is what makes it necessary, I think, in the screenplay.
Right.
Otherwise, it's just like, okay, we get it, you know, we've seen this already the whole movie, but it's not for the audience, it's for the character, which is, like, a lot of times movies nowadays are like, saying things for the audience's sake, and you're like, oh, it's kind of like eye-rollingly. So, and like, but it serves no purpose to the characters in the movie. And I'm like, why? I get it. We get it. You want this applause, but yeah, it was cool. I like that.
Yeah.
But anyway, I know that was backtracking a little bit, but.
No, great point. Yeah. So at this moment, if she looks at Cal after he said this very despicable thing, she looks back at her mother sitting in the safety of this lifeboat. There's a seat for her right there. And she's actively making the decision and realizing, you know, getting into the boat with these people is just not worth it. And it's just not what she wants right now. She would rather completely reject a life of safety rather than continue to be tied to these people. So that's when she just says, goodbye, mother. And you know, that's it. Just goodbye, mother. She power walks out of there to try to, you know, go back to find Jack. Cal chases after her, forcibly grabs her. What else is new? This guy, very controlling. And he just can't accept that she does not want him. She just can't accept it. Rose being who she is not something that he is used to or would expect. And he's just so, he just can't handle it. He is this wealthy, rich guy, arrogant guy who just thinks he has it all.
Yeah.
Who wouldn't want to be with me? You know what I mean? Yeah. He doesn't understand that there's so much more to a relationship than just, you know, financial stability or just him giving her anything she wants and all this stuff. You know, he just can't get it through his head that she would rather be with this poor guy, you know, and he asks her that.
Rose, come back here.
Are you calling? Right now. Hold on. Go to him. You whore to a gutter rat!
And she bites back with that quote.
No, wait!
I'd rather be his whore than your wife.
It's a good line.
It's actually, it's a line from Twin Peaks, actually.
Oh, really?
That's right. I remember hearing that, and I remember seeing a clip from it where it's like pretty much the same exact line. And someone was like, okay, James Cameron. Which, you know. But yeah, but still a great line. Works really well in this context, too.
Yeah. And then the greatest setup and payoff ever with
it
her
is,
hawking a loogie in his face.
It is great.
Because she was learning how to hawk a loogie earlier in the movie, and now she uses her newfound skill to hawk a loogie in her fiance's face.
Yes, she does, but hey.
It's so good.
It does feel like very...
Yeah. Oh, I'm not complaining. I laughed when it happened because I was like, that's the most creative Chekhov's gun I've ever seen in a movie. But
it's great. There's a blurb about that. It's a quote from James Cameron. During production rehearsals, Kate suggested that rather than poke Cal with a hairpin or a hat pin, that was like the original plan. Like she was going to rip a pin out of her hair and like stab him in the face with it or something. Like just something ridiculous.
Oh my gosh.
She suggested that Rose should spit in Cal's face. I loved the suggestion immediately because getting back at Cal using a skill she learned from Jack has that perfect dramatic symmetry.
Yeah.
It's a great indicator for how much she's grown as a character.
Yeah. Using this very like quote unquote low life way of handling something instead of the first class way that she would have handled it with her hairpin.
And then it says Cal is too shocked to run after her because Rose has made her point so powerfully. But it was funny, the I'd rather be his whore than your wife bit. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I mentioned this before. I might have. But when I showed Titanic to some of my high school students that I teach, they were so into it. And then by the time this scene came and it was like, oh, I'd rather be his whore than your wife, the kids were literally like, oh!
Yeah, that's pretty good.
It was so funny. They were like, oh. And then she spits at him, oh. You know, it made a line like that still feel relevant and edgy and cool of Rose to have said.
Yeah, definitely. I wonder if it had the same reaction in 1997. Hmm. People running up and down the aisles. Like a freestyle battle.
Breaking out the air horns. Like the super hot fire meme, you know that?
Yeah.
Anyway, so it's pretty great too how before Rose spits on him, you know, he's literally saying, no, I said no. This man who can't take no for an answer. And then that is what she does. She just spits in his face, runs away. And as the blurb in the screenplay said, he was too shocked to even run after her because that was quite a strong point she made there.
Yeah. Good moment. I would want to say I wish they had showed Ruth kind of descending a little bit until like you couldn't see her anymore. Mm. Almost. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That'd have been kind of cool, but
it always gives me anxiety when she's like holding on so tight as Rose runs away and she's calling after her, because I'm just like, what if she's just left hanging there on the side of the Titanic? You know what I mean? Like she, you know. I always think about it.
They show a wide shot and she's like, nah!
Oh my god.
Her legs are kicking and stuff.
Oh my goodness. I just always think about it though, because they cut away as the boat is lowering, but her hands are still like holding on for dear life. You know?
Yeah.
But that's where I have the end of this scene marked, because after this, it directly goes into like a much more heightened. The sinking's really taken off. Rose is going on a mission to find Jack. It gets really intense after this moment, and the score starts ramping up. And
I didn't want to stop watching. I had to stop myself from continuing. But
oh, I know. That happens to me every time, too. I keep watching it, and then next thing I know, I'm like 15 minutes after I said I would stop watching it, and then I'm like, oh, crap, wait, no.
Especially this part, because it's like, this is when it really gets good.
Yeah, I really do say it's like a masterclass in maintaining tension when we all know the outcome.
Yeah.
It's pretty difficult to do that sometimes. You know, most movies, you're maintaining tension without knowing the outcome. And sometimes even that's hard to do.
But yeah, it's a good scene. Can't wait to see the next one.
I know. I'm excited because it's getting real.
This is literally, we're in the climax right now. So it's the best part of the movie, I think. It's the marquee matchup, right? This is what you're paying to see, is the Titanic sinking. I mean, I'm talking about like if you've never seen it before, you're like, okay, this is what I was expecting, and now it's happening really amazingly.
So that will just about do it for Women and Children First. Thank you guys so much for listening. We really appreciate it. Follow on all of the socials. Shoot us an email at titanicscenebyscene@gmail.com. Leave us a voice message via Anchor and all that good stuff. Thank you guys so much for listening, and we will see you in the next scene.
See ya.